Yeah, well, the idea, though, is that there are some animals that do not fit in the evolutionary... I mean, the idea that the great chain of being, it's the idea that you got all these animals that have just very slight variations, and so the idea is that they all must have descended from each other. But what they're always forgetting to point out is that there's huge gaps. Usually, at least for sure with the phyla, and then of course you've got other classifications, you know, different kinds of things. Species can be very close. You can have two different species that are very close. They can even interbreed and have offspring. But when you get higher, like in the level of genera, and then even higher in the level of family or genus and then family. But then when you get to the phyla, I mean, there's not any... How do you compare arthropoda, which is a phyla, to say, spiny fish, which is a phyla? Arthropoda is like just like crayfish and lobster and scorpions and insects, and that's one phyla. And they all have some things in common. They have the exoskeleton, they've got the jointed limbs, and they're very similar in some ways, but there's nothing in between that and, say, spiny fish, or you know what you call bony fish, that's what they call bony fish. I mean, they're just completely different. One of them has scales, and one of them has, you know, and air sacs and all that. But you could say all the fish are very similar, right? But you've got some serious differences in fish that there's nothing linking them, like the difference between bony fish and cartilaginous fish that don't have spines and ribs. I don't know. It's just like... these are seriously different things, and if you're going to truly believe in evolution, there's got to be some steps between those. And so they've been looking at fossils for 150, 200 years, trying to find the steps in between those, and what happens is they find a whole lot of more examples of animals that we already know about. Like they'll find, you know, ancient dragonflies, or they'll find ancient crocodiles, or they'll find ancient reptiles or ancient birds, but they don't find something in between those. And I guess the only one that they come up with is the Archaeopteryx, which is supposedly a feathered reptile. It really is a bird with teeth. That's what it is. So it's a funny bird, a flying bird that has feathers. And has teeth. And there are other birds, prehistoric birds, that had teeth, so it's not really that unusual. And it's not truly an intermediary. It's not a reptile that couldn't fly. It's not a reptile that's developing feathers, which feathers are for flight. The feathers are for, you know, at least these flight feathers are. I guess you could have a feather that's for something else. But there are no reptiles that are feathered that can't fly. You have this Archaeopteryx. Now, I know that nowadays they're saying that all these two-legged reptiles had, you know, a lot of them had feathers. And it's because they find some little evidence of it in the fossils, and it's not a given. But, in other words, somebody else could interpret it a different way. And I would always recommend, if you guys have any interest in this, and in fact, I think in what I'm going to study today about the book of Job, it's a very important issue, because this is the major problem with our modern world. And I think the theory of evolution is the major problem with our modern world. It started going downhill because of the theory of evolution, and the theory of evolution is the backbone of everything that's wrong with our modern society. It's the reason why we have so much unwed motherhood, and the reason why we have so much gang violence, the reason why nations have caused world wars, and why communism came about. All these things can be traced right back to evolution. It's even responsible for this modern kind of racism, this idea that our race is better than your race. That's directly related to ideas about evolution. Not since Darwin. Remember, evolution was before Darwin. Evolution is the philosophy that it all just happened by processes. And what kind of processes can produce these things? These are not. In fact, what I was going to deal with about the book of Job goes through all of these creation events, these things that had to have been created. And anybody who knows anything about creating something, you know that it's not something that just happens. It has to be thought out. It has to be tried out. It has to be debugged. Everything has to be done in order to produce something that works. So evolution is a non-starter. It's not scientific. It's not even a good idea. If you're looking at it from the philosophical standpoint, the idea that evolution is possible is a non-starter. It's ridiculous. Evolution, they do the bait and switch thing where they'll talk about evolution and they'll show how, you know, one kind of a bird can turn into another kind of a bird. And yeah, okay, I can see that because you have something already there and it can sort of, you know, make some minor changes. This is called microevolution. Now that's what they name it now. But you can see that. But then they'll do the bait and switch and then they'll pretend that that justifies this idea that arthropods can turn into bony fish. Or that jellyfish type can turn into arthropods. And they've been looking at the fossils. And like I said, they went up to this one place up there in Canada, the Burgess Shale, and this one guy, Stephen J. Gold, he wrote a book on it. I read the book. It was fascinating. It's not a creationist book by any stretch of the imagination. He was looking for missing links. But what he found was 20 new phyla, 20 new kinds of animals that are as distinct from other animals as phyla are distinct from each other. So the difference between arthropods like scorpions and bony fish, the difference between those two is so wide that there's nothing to hook them together, you know. And the difference between an amphibian like a salamander and a lungfish, they're completely different animals. They just don't connect. There aren't anything in between them. But instead of finding something in between them, he finds 20 more. There used to be 28 phyla, and now there are 48 phyla. Just in one find, he found 20 new types of animals. And then all the what we were talking about, the platypus, the idea that one, this animal, it's a mammal, yeah, but it's, you know, this is a very, very weird mammal. And there's nothing connecting it to even other mammals. It almost has to be classified all by itself. It's just a very strange animal. And there are many animals like that. These are strange, strange animals. And they are so different that it's beyond the capability of microevolution. Microevolution happens because genetic material can deteriorate. You can have what they call random mutations by radiation or somatic corruption, which means it's your cells begin to lose their viability, and so things happen and they don't reproduce correctly. You can have when the genome splits when the genome is reproducing itself, it can wind up lining up wrong and adding or doubling up on some of the coding that's there, and it can produce differences in it. The vast majority of the changes, the differences that are caused by these microevolutionary events is negative. It kills off whatever happens. But it is not impossible you could even imagine it, some small improvement could possibly happen. You know, like, you get an extra finger or something, you know, I don't know. I'm just trying to, you know, ballpark it here. The idea is something might happen, but trying to bridge the gap from microevolution to macroevolution, where you go from the jellyfish type of animals, which have nothing at all, and then you get to the exoskeleton type animals, which is like the arthropoda. Those are such completely different animals. And there's nothing in between. In other words, there is no basis in facts, in science. Now, they've got all kinds of secondary or what we could say peripheral proofs. One of the peripheral proofs is great ages. They say, well, look how old the earth is. So something had to happen in all that time. And some of us just have some real serious doubts about how old the earth is. I also have serious doubts about the earth being only 6,000 years old, because I see things that I don't know how to explain, you know, how this happened in the flood and since the flood. There's a lot of things that I don't understand. And they find evidences of greater age. And then you have the young earthers. They find evidences that it's younger than that. Like I'm sure you, if you guys will read them, you read anything by Answers in Genesis. I just go onto their website every so often and just read what article is displaying. Or I'll go in there and type. I saw them. They had discovered a fossil. It was some kind of a dolphin like fish, or I don't care what it was, but anyway, it came out and they were making it out like it's this brand new, you know, they'd found out this is going to prove this, and this is the link between this and whatever. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. So I went on to Answers in Genesis and just typed in the name of that thing, and they had a 3 or 4 year old article on it showing the gaps in their understanding and why we just cannot tell that this proves anything. They really are good as far as giving you the answers. Answers in Genesis, that's the .com, that's one of them. They're the ones that made that ark up there in Kentucky, so that's the same group. Another one is ICR, which is Institute for Creation Research. That's the guy that started that is this guy here, Henry Morris. Henry Morris is a believing genius. He believed the Bible. He actually even became a King James man toward the end of his life. He used to, you know, quote all the different versions. He finally said, you know, forget it. He just started sticking with the old King James. And even though people criticized him for it, he stuck with it. I'm very impressed with him. He's got a son, John Morris, who's sort of following in his footsteps and took over the ICR, the Institute for Creation Research. And they are very good. The problem is there's a whole lot of other ones. The Scientific Creationism Institute, or Institute I forget their names. I don't go to them anymore. A whole lot of creationists have some wild theories that they really go with. And they're not scientific. And they're not grounded. And I think they get way off. And I've heard so many crazy creationist theories that I had to just walk away from and say, this is crazy. They talk about a helium dome that turns into metal, and I'm thinking, where do they come up with this? And they really are grasping at straws, and I think it's very foolish. So you need to make sure you stick with reputable scientific minds. And Answers in Genesis and Institute for Creation Research both are that way. There's a couple others, but I can't remember them right now. Didn't we show some of those?
Is Genesis History?
We watched them. I don't know why, but I can't.
They're very calm when they're talking about it. And they don't sound like they're going on a tangent.
Yeah.
We watched that, and I don't know that I disagreed with it, but at this moment I can't remember anything that we saw.
The one guy, they're at Mount St. Helens, and that one guy.
Oh, yeah. That's Stephen Austin. He did the study. Stephen Austin did the study on Mount St. Helens to demonstrate what causes something like the Grand Canyon. And many, many other canyons all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that, and he does a good job of proving it. He also explained, it was him that discovered it, he explained how those intact fossilized forests happen. Because they, and I remember, in fact, in that book that I brought by Henry Morris the other time, what's it called? The Genesis Flood. That's the major work that's got young earth creationism started back in the 60s. It's a fantastic book. It's still relevant. It's a little bit out of date, but it's still relevant today. But in there, one of the objections that was brought up was that in Yellowstone they've got forests that have grown into sedimentary rock with fossils, and then other sedimentary rock has covered them, and then other forests have grown on top of that, and they show these petrified logs with their roots and everything into these sedimentary layers, and then other layers, then other logs on top of that, and then other logs on top of that. And I thought, at the time when I saw that, I thought, well, that is proof that that didn't happen in the flood, because how could a forest grow? It just didn't fit with the Bible. But then Stephen Austin comes and shows how it's happening right now at Spirit Lake up there. And that's how all these logs get. When you have a big flood event like that, it just shoves all of these, you have a mudslide, and it shoves all of these logs together with their roots intact, and they float on the water, and as they get waterlogged, they sink, and the roots sink first, so then they go down to the bottom, and they just stand like that at the bottom of the lake, and the sediment keeps filling in, and then others fall down. In fact, that lake, that Spirit Lake, one video, it shows that it's still like half covered with logs. They haven't waterlogged yet. So they're doing it a little at a time. So over the space of several years, you'll have several layers, what looks like forests in place, intact. And it's a deception. It's not true. So things like that happen, and it's a tremendous hoax that's happening here. And it's the biggest, catalyst for the evil that's happening in our modern world. This theory of evolution is not innocent. It is rooted in an unbelief, a rejection of God and creation and supernatural beginnings. It's a rejection of personal responsibility to a creator. It is people liking the idea of getting rid of religion. And all of us would like to get rid of religious restrictions. I mean, there's a natural tendency in our natures that we would like to shed the shackles and just live free and not have to worry about conscience. We don't want to have to worry about pleasing God or, doing the right thing. We would like to just live whatever we want to do what we want to do and nobody tell us anything. That desire motivates the belief in evolution. It really does. That is what causes it. And they don't recognize that that's the desire that's causing it. But because they adopt the theory of evolution, and they've done it now for 300 or 400 years, because they adopt this, all of these anti-Bible people from the beginning have believed in this evolutionary hypothesis, and Darwin gave it wings. Darwin made it possible to be scientific and believe in evolution. Before that, the scientists didn't believe in it. Only the theorists would believe in something like evolution. Lamarck and even Erasmus Darwin, grandpa of Charles. But because the doctrine of evolution has become so. It's so confusing. It makes you think that it's possible for all of this to have just happened. And I was going to touch on the book of Job just briefly. It's not really a survey of the book of Job, because there's lots of other things very important in it. How many have read the book of Job? Everybody read the book of Job? How many have read it 5 times? How many times? But if you read it and just really pay attention to what you read, some things start sinking in. Some things start... Is it hot? Am I sweating?
It is hot. It's warm in here.
You know how to turn that thing down? Kick that thing on and get us a little bit more comfortable.
It's usually freezing. I know. I'm enjoying that myself. But I brought my jacket.
Well, if you want to get a big old palm and fan me, that'd be fine. I don't mind.
Yeah, I brought my jacket instead.
Anyway, the book of Job Well, let me ask you a question. What I was going to say is the book of Job, if you read it enough times, there are some things that just strike you. It's one of the most fascinating books of the Bible. Henry Morris thinks it is the most fascinating book of the Bible. And I understand why he says that. But I have a hard time. The Remarkable Record of Job by Henry Morris. I'm sort of outlining his book here a little bit. He agrees with me, or I agree with him. He's way older than me, so I have to agree with him. But he has the same view of the book of Job that I do, but he adds in all the scientific stuff. He sees scientific things in the book of Job that I would not have noticed. And that's the reason why I took records out of him. But the idea is that he says it's the most fascinating book in the Bible. And my problem with saying something is the most is because you just got to think about other books. Like, you know, think about Hebrews, or think about the book of Acts, or how about the book of Genesis? What a fascinating book. How can you say one book is the most fascinating book? Revelation. There's a lot of fascinating books in the Bible that just blow you away. And so I don't want to be too superlative and say it's the greatest book ever, you know. But it is a remarkable book. I don't know if you guys have noticed the same thing I've noticed when you read the book of Job. For example, what are the evidences? Well, no, let me ask you first this. What do you think the book of Job is about? You're actually close. Well, you both are very close to what he says, and I agree with him. What I've always heard, my dad taught it to me, and I've read it in other commentaries and heard it preached on how many times, that the book of Job is about why do the righteous suffer, explaining why the righteous suffer. It's the righteous sufferer. It's a theme in a bunch of different books in history. The righteous sufferer. Somebody who didn't deserve it gets, you know, a bad deal, what have you. The problem with saying that the book of Job is about that it was written for that reason and that's what it's trying to get across, is the problem with that is that it never answers that question.
Yeah.
Yeah, why did Job suffer? Well, by the whim of God. It was the caprice of God. God just said, yeah, let him suffer. And that doesn't really answer our question. And it doesn't give me a lot of confidence in God. Think about it. If God will allow Job to just go through all of that just because he had an argument with Satan up there in heaven, it makes me think, well, good grief, what could he do to me? And just for no reason. It doesn't fill me with confidence in God for giving me an answer about why the righteous suffer. What good came from Job's suffering? Almost no good at all. No good for Job. No good for his friends. No good for his wife. No good for his children. I can't think of any good that came from Job except in the sense that he's going to get a reward after he dies, you know. But there's no revival. Somebody says, well, he doubled his wealth. At the end, he had twice as many camels and twice as many horses and whatever. And same number of children and the same mean old wife. But the truth is he had 140 years to double his wealth, and that's not a bull market. 140 years to double your wealth is not fast growth. So it's not like, you know, it's not like trying to prove something that Job really came out better in the end. No, there's no answer to that kind of a question. So the question then becomes, why was it written? Why did it happen to Job? What was the purpose? And if you read the book of Job, you find that it's talking about creation. All the way through it, it's talking about creation. And he makes the point, which I hadn't seen before I read this book. He makes the point that the point of the book of Job is that God is the creator, and that means something. He can do whatever he wants. He has absolute right over his creation. And if you'll read the last four chapters, not the last four, out of the last five, the not counting the last one, so chapters 38 through 41, four chapters of God's diatribe, God's soliloquy, God just goes on a rant and says, who's this that darkeneth counsel with words without knowledge? Who do you think you are talking to me like this? And then he just starts going into all these things that he created. And Henry Morris sees the scientific significance of these things that, that God says, that God mentions. And so I wanted to go over that a little bit with you. Consider, but the point of the book of Job is that God is saying, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I have a right. And if that's true, if that's the point of the book of Job, and I think it's probably the oldest book in the Bible, the only one that could rival it, in my opinion, is the book of Genesis. But if it's true, then God is making a point from the beginning that creation is of supreme importance, that there is a creator, and because everything descended from his mind, he has rights. He has privileges. He deserves to be worshipped. He deserves to be praised. He deserves our lives. He deserves everything about it. And it's a complete different attitude than what we see in society and even what we see in churches today. Because you'll find churches, it's all focused on what we deserve. What is for us. It's so man-centered. And it's also this life-centered. It's how God can improve your life right now. It's not about how God's going to take care of you in another life. It's all about right now. So everything has gotten twisted. It's gotten corrupted. It's all gone downhill since we lost the concept of creation. And that's what's happened in the last 200 years. We've lost the amazement that we should have at the idea of creation. What it means to be, well, think about it. What does it mean to be a creator? I mean, the creator. Everything here exists because of his will, because of his genius, because of his power. Everything does. And so, but what does that mean then in my mind, in my life? It means that I don't have the right to go whining to him over anything. It gives him rights. It gives him merits. We're entitlement. God has all of these entitlements. And what the book of Job all the way through points out, and both sides of the argument during the different rebuttals and back and forths, all of the arguments center around the Almighty God. God making these decisions about people and what kind of things he does. And Job's point is he doesn't have a reason. And their point is he always has the reason. There's a reason behind why you're suffering. And the point of the book of Job is no, there was no reason whatsoever except God's whim. And then God defends himself at the end. He doesn't say, I'm sorry, Job. I didn't mean to put you through that. I'll make it up to you. He didn't do that at all. He rebuked Job and said, I'm the creator. I do what I want. Now, that's the book in a nutshell. So now I can say I've done a survey of the book of Job. First of all, the age of the book of Job is seen by a number of issues. A couple of them he brought out that I hadn't remembered. First of all, the age of Job when he died. He lived 140 years after his first family died. And so you just add some years on for 10 children that he had after that, say 40 years. That means he lived at least 180 years, probably closer to 200 years old. Now, you want to know when Job lived and what time period? Find when the ages were around the year 200 years old. And that would be around the time of Abraham, maybe slightly before. For example, Reu lived to be 239, Sarug 230, Nahor lived to be 148, that was Abraham's grandfather, Terah lived to be 205, that was Abraham's father, Abraham lived to be 175, Isaac lived to be 180. So you can see how the ages are going down when they die. And that was very consistent all the way from Noah all the way down. Noah lived 950. Shem lived 700-something, you know, and Arphaxad lived 500. Let's go down to 400, Peleg, you know, and they go down. They get down to Isaac living 180. So Job probably lived around the time of Abraham, possibly slightly before, because if he lived 200 years old, then he's one of those old timers that could, you know, that still didn't have all those somatic aberrations in their body. Those are accumulated over the years. We get these abnormalities in our body accumulated because of corruption of the genome. And this is a settled science. They know how this happens. And so now we only live to be, you know, 80, 70 or 80 or 90 years old. And that's with a whole lot of work to try to keep us living that long. If we didn't have all these things, we'd be dying at 60 and 70 years old, just like they used to. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why we place it at before Moses, probably 400 years before Moses. So around the year 2000 BC is when he lived. Now, I want you to notice when you read the book of Job, I want you to notice the references to God, the word God, which in the Hebrew is Elohim, and then the references to the word Almighty. All right, there's 117 references to God. There's 31 references to Almighty, and there's a few others. The Most High, or the Maker. There's a bunch of references like that referring to God. But I want you to notice that, oh yeah, there's one reference to the word Lord, Adonai, which is Lord with the small letters. And there are 32 references to the word Jehovah. But if you will pay attention, all the references to the word Jehovah are in the prologue and in the epilogue. That's the first two chapters and the last chapter. So the first two chapters mention Jehovah like 20 times. And the last chapter mentions Jehovah like 10 times, something like that. Now, pay attention to this. How did this happen? How is it that Jehovah, as the name of God, is mentioned only in the prologue and only in the epilogue, and not once in all of those back and forth between Job and Eliphaz and Zophar and Bildad and I forget all the ones, and Elihu, they all are talking and talking, and they just talk, and they talk about God all the time, and not one of them mentions Jehovah. The only one that mentions Jehovah is whoever wrote the prologue and the epilogue at the end. Jehovah's not mentioned once in the arguments in between, which is an indication that the prologue and the epilogue were written later to give the context of the play. Obviously, this was a play. This was what they would do is they would act this out as a play, apparently, and one would talk and the other talk, and they'd have this rebuttal, just like they do plays nowadays, and this allowed people to remember the story of Job. And that's how it came to be in the place that it is. That's how it exists that way. But obviously the play part of it, the part where we're remembering what those people said, and that doesn't mean that it's fiction, by the way. Back in those days, people would remember what was said because that was the kind of mind they had. People who live in oral societies to this day can remember an entire conversation that two people have because they're not thinking in terms of written words. They memorialize things in their mind by associations. And you can train yourself to do that. There are people who can do amazing feats of memory by training the way oral people did. But what happens is they set up their remembrances of it in meter, or in not rhyme, but in certain types of rhythm. And you find it all the way through the book of Job. It's almost like poetry, because that's why it fits into verses so well. But obviously, this happened, but they always speak about these as real people, because it doesn't just say, here's this man named Job, and then it just goes into that. No, it tells us who he was, where he was from, and the names of these people, and the cities they were from, and who their parents were, and how old they were, and it just goes, it goes into a lot of detail about these persons. So these are real people that had an argument, and this argument was spectated. It was viewed by other people. Elihu was one of the people watching this pan out. There was this, apparently Job was a very important person, and these other people were very important. And when they had this get together where they started talking, a lot of people were there, and it was remembered. And then much later on, the Jews think it was Moses that did it, that wrote the prologue and the epilogue to say who this was, because they, most people knew who it was, but if it's now a book and it's got to be memorialized for the future, they say, okay, we got to put down the context. So they add the first two chapters and the last chapter to explain what happened, and that apparently was done later. And the reason why I say that is because Exodus 6:3, God says to Moses, when I talked to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, I appeared to them by the name of, by the name of God Almighty, Elohim Shaddai, or something like that. The word Almighty, Shaddai. He says, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the name God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. Now that doesn't mean they didn't know the name Jehovah. It just means God did not appear to them with that name. The name Jehovah was more of a generic type of a name, apparently. And the concept of the Almighty God that created everything, he was known as God Almighty. And you have, before Moses, which is when the word Jehovah became the go-to name for God, which then infects everything else in the Bible. It's throughout the Bible. But when you find a place where the word Jehovah is not used, then it makes you think that's an older part, because Jehovah is so pervasive after Moses. So that's how people can go into the book of Genesis and say, this is a copy of something that came from before. Moses is copying something that somebody else wrote. See what I'm saying? And that's what happened here in Job, apparently. And so that predates it. If it's true, then that predates that part of Job. It predates it before Moses, because Moses is the one that popularized the name Jehovah. Although it did exist before, Abraham used it. He called the place Jehovah Jireh one time, and several times they call on the name of the Lord, Jehovah. So it was a name of God, but it wasn't the go-to name that God used to appear to people. Anyway, and so it wasn't used as much. Anyway. Also, there's a bunch of non-mentions in the book of Job. Things that should have been mentioned at least once in the book of Job if it was after Moses. If it was written after Moses, things would have been mentioned. For example, polytheism would have been mentioned. Not having any other gods and all these idolaters and all that stuff. From Moses on, that's a huge issue. It never stops being a huge issue, but it's not mentioned one time in the book of Job. There's no polytheists. There's no images that they're dealing with. They're not talking about the idolaters. There's no rebuke of this kind of thing. The only thing I would hesitate on that is that there's one spot where Job mentions worshiping the sun and the moon. Job 31, where Job actually says, if I, you know, ever was mean to a widow, then let my right hand, you know, fall off, or something like that. I'm just, you know, ballparking it there. I'm not sure exactly what he said. But then he keeps on going and says, if I ever looked at the sun or the moon and kissed my hand and trusted in that, he says, then let something else bad happen to me. That's the only reference. It's a passing reference to the worship of the sun and the moon. So idolatry was not a big thing. That puts it in the patriarchal period before Abraham, because by the time of Abraham, there were idolaters. Abraham came out of idolatry, says so in Joshua. In my mind, that places it before the time of Abraham. Also, it never mentions patriarchs. Never mentions Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. Anything after Moses, they are mentioned all the time. The reason why Israel is important is because of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It never mentions the Exodus or the post-Exodus or the nation of Israel. It doesn't mention the wanderings. It doesn't mention the conquest. It doesn't mention Joshua or Caleb or any kind of thing like that. It never mentions any of the laws of Moses. And here's a disclaimer. In Job 22:22, Eliphaz refers to God's law, the law of his mouth. Not Moses' law, but God's law. Job 23:12, Job refers to God's commandment of his lips. The commandment of his lips. Job 36:10, Elihu refers to God's command to return from iniquity, trying to get Job to repent. And you can also look in Genesis 26:5, where Abraham, God says about Abraham, he obeys my laws. This is before Moses. So there are laws that God has. These are the commandments of his lips, his will, things that we know about God from before Moses, and that's what is talked about in the book of Job. There's no priest. What we find is Job offering sacrifices directly for his own family, which is the way it was done in the time of Abraham and in the time of Noah. All of them, they offered their sacrifices directly. There was no priesthood, no priestcraft. There was no tabernacle, no temple. There was no place, no synagogue, no shrine, no spot where they were supposed to go. There were no clean or unclean beasts. You don't find that even mentioned in the book of Job, which is a huge deal all through the Bible, clean and unclean beasts. There are no Sabbaths or holy days mentioned in the book of Job. Never comes up. It doesn't say that they were on a Sabbath doing this and they were doing... No, it's not even brought up. Exactly like the time of Abraham. No Sabbaths mentioned. They did not obey the Sabbath laws in the times of Abraham or Nahor or Terah or Noah. That came well after. That came out of Moses. All right. There's another thing, not just the non-mentions. There's some places that are mentioned, like the place called Uz, Job 1:1. We find Uz mentioned in Genesis chapter 10, verse 23. That's when the dispersion of the nations. That's in the patriarchal period. So the place called Uz is mentioned in the patriarchal period. That's where Job was from. It's called a place in the east. He was the richest man in the east. That's the Uz in the east. You'll find an Uz in Edom mentioned much later, but Edom's to the south. So that's not the same Uz. The Uz that's in the east is mentioned in Genesis chapter 10. You have the Chaldeans that are mentioned. That's mentioned in Job. They came and did some mischief to Job's family. And you find the Chaldeans mentioned in Genesis 15 in the time of the patriarchal period. You find the Sabaeans mentioned in Job. They're also mentioned in Genesis 10, or at least apparently the parent Seba of the Sabaeans. And, of course, you find the gold of Ophir mentioned, and that's also very ancient. Genesis 10:29 mentions it. They're also mentioned. Ophir lasted a long time. They were still digging gold out of Ophir in the times of Solomon. All right. You have names that are mentioned. That's also very interesting. Some of the names in the book of Job are actually found in archaeological sites of the area in around the year 2000 BC. Job, the word Job is found in four sites. Tel El Amarna, Mari, Alaka, Alalak, and in Egypt. Bildad, the name Bildad is found in cuneiform text in the year around the year 2000 BC. You have Tema, that's found in Genesis 25. He's the son of Ishmael. You have Teman, which is the grandson of Esau. You have Shua, Bildad the Shuhite. You have Shua. He was mentioned. He was the son of Abraham by Keturah, and he was sent to the east. So this might actually give us clues as to who these people were. And you have a fella called Buzz. I think it was Huz and Buzz. That was the brothers. Huz and Buzz, sons of Nahor. So around the time of Abraham, you got these names that are common and they're found in the book of Job. There's a lot of, to me, this is a lot of evidence pointing to it. Then you have some events that are mentioned that are curious. Like, for example, in Job 4:18, it says, his angels he charged with folly. He charged his angels with folly. And what we find is that, you know, in the book of Genesis, it talks about him, about the angels that left their first estate, you know, that sort of thing. Also, creation is prominent in their mind throughout it. all the way through the book of Job, they're talking about creation, and I'm not going to go into those verses. The flood is remembered almost as if it's something that, you know, wasn't that long ago, it seems to me. But that also happens in the book of Joshua. They talk about people on the other side of the flood. So, and Joshua is around the year 1500, so that's about 1,000 years or so after the flood. So maybe that's not great evidence, but it's still interesting. Talks about compassing the earth with water, compassing the waters with bounds till day and night end. That's a reference to God's promise that he'll never destroy the earth with a flood again. Okay. It says the waters break forth as out of the womb, to, and then they were sent to the decreed place where God sent them. Anyway, another point to be made is that the ice age seems to be referenced in the book of Job. Because remember, after the flood, the best guess of our creationist scientists is that after the flood, all the evaporation, all of that stuff that happens after the flood produced the ice ages. And that means that's where the ice sheets come from, the north and the south, and they just cover a huge chunk of the northern hemisphere and a huge chunk of the southern hemisphere. And we still see evidences of it today, like Yosemite Canyon and places like that, evidences of the ice age. And the book of Job talks about snow and ice more than any other book in the Bible. It talks about frost and the treasure of the snow and the hail, from whose womb came the ice, waters as stone, face of the deep is frozen. It's found in the book of Job. It talks about ice, and that's interesting because almost no other book in the Bible talks about ice, because in the time later on, ice wasn't a big deal in that area. All right. I just wanted to point out, okay, now there's other things. There's references to creation commands, like Job 9:7, he commandeth the sun. God commandeth the sun. Job 36:32, he commandeth the light. 36:32, he commandeth the clouds. 38:12, commandeth the morning or the day spring. 39:27, commandeth the eagle. That's an interesting concept because everything is pointed to God doing the commands. God is making these things happen. Also references to maker, to making, to forming, to fashioning. Job 4:17, more pure than his maker. Job 9:9, he maketh Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades, those constellations. Job 10, thine hands have made me and fashioned me together round about. Job talking about being made personally by God, the maker. Job 26:13, by his spirit he hath garnished the heavens. He made the heavens pretty by his spirit. Isn't that interesting? His hand formed the crooked serpent. He makes the weight for the winds. He measures the waters with his hands. Did not he that made me in the womb make him? Did not one fashion us in the womb? In so doing, my maker would soon take me away. Behold, I am also formed out of the clay. Where is God, my maker, who giveth songs in the night? Things of that nature. I will fetch knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my maker. He maketh the small drops of water that causes rain. He that made him can make his sword approach to him. Constantly talking about God as the maker, as the creator. Then there are references to very complex scientific subjects. I don't think this is supernatural inspiration that God is giving us glimpses of scientific discoveries from later so that we can go back and prove the Bible is supernatural because it has scientific discoveries. I don't believe that. I believe these ancients had a lot of knowledge. I believe they were a lot smarter than we give them credit for. These were not cavemen. They may have had some backwards thinking when it comes to killing each other and slavery and polygamy and things like that. They had some backwards thinking, a lot of them, but I think they were very smart, especially when it comes to astronomy and it comes to geology and things like that. This guy, Henry Morris, knows a lot of these things. He shows how in the book of Job, these ancients understood things that we didn't really figure out until much later. For example, hydrology. talks about the weight for the winds, the fact that air has weight wasn't really understood well, and the fact that water in the air has weight, and that the balance of the weight of air, which is a combination of nitrogen and oxygen, and the weight of water that's in the air, that that is a tremendous important balance, what we call, you know, humidity. This is what causes our hydrological cycle today. That's why we have rain. It also mentions the way for lightning, how lightning produces rain. You might be surprised, but the constant evaporation is carrying electrons up to the top of the heavens, and so that gives the earth a positive charge, and up in the height of the heavens, it's a negative charge, and so bang, the lightning has to release itself. It has to come back. And that lightning actually produces rain and causes the precipitation events to happen. Interesting. In Job 36, let's go to that one, because it's actually rather complicated. Job 36, this was spoken of by Elihu, not a terribly inspired guy. Everything he said just about was wrong. I've actually read commentators, and I've actually heard preachers say that Elihu was the one who wrote the book, and Elihu is the one that is right and everything. But and because God never corrects him. And this is true, God doesn't correct him. I think it's because he was a young whippersnapper and he thought nobody's going to listen to him anyway. All right, look at Job chapter 36 and verse 27. He says, "For he maketh small the drops of water. They poured down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Also can any understand the spreadings of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle?" Goes on, there's other parts in there too, but he makes the point. This guy, he has a PhD in hydrology, this Henry Morris. That's how he's a science. He was a scientist at the University of Virginia in hydrology when he got into trying to prove that the Bible is more scientific than other things. Then he became famous for other reasons. But he was a hydrologist. He points out that that clouds is not water vapor. Water vapor is invisible. You can't see water vapor. It's right, it's in here. There is a balance between the oxygen, nitrogen, and water vapor right in here. And it's absolutely invisible. But what you can see, like clouds, is actually small drops of water. They're microscopic drops of water, but they have to coalesce. And they can't coalesce. They can't come out of the vapor state except through particles. You got to have dust. You got to have some kind of a dust to cause it to precipitate, to gather the water. It's got to form on something. Otherwise, it supersaturates and it never comes out. But once you have some dust or some like that, and then lightning and what have you, the whole thing can come out. And this here is like a really good understanding of how the hydrological cycle works. Job 37:16, "Dost thou know the balancing of the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge?" What do you think they mean back in 2,000 years before Christ about the balancing of the clouds? It's almost like, you know, you're thinking, how do those clouds stay up in the air? Because water is heavier than air. Why do clouds stay up in the air? Anybody have an idea? Water vapor goes up, but water droplets, even minute ones, are heavier. They turned into liquid. They're like 100 times heavier than air. So any drop of water is 100 times heavier than the air around it.
And the movement of the wind, but whatever the air is up there, it's a little higher, and the flow and movement, does that help over there?
Well, the flow would make it move, but it would eventually fall because, you know, it's...
run out of flow.
Yeah, what goes up has to come down. But, no, you're right in a sense. What happens is, because of evaporation and water vapor lighter than air starts going up, and that's how the electrons get carried to the top. That's what produces lightning. But the fact that it's going up causes updrafts, so there is a balancing of the updraft with the weight of the water. So the clouds start coalescing into little water droplets, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and so they get heavier, 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 and the water vapor is coming up, causing those, there's an updraft, so it balances the clouds where they are, and you'll see that there's a spot which has to do with the temperature. That's why they have all these humidity ratings and all that, tell you how high or how low or what the temperature is. And what you'll see, the cloud is flat on the bottom, because when it gets to a certain temperature, it turns into the water vapors, and it can't come down below because of the force up, and then the weight gets bigger and bigger, and the whole cloud keeps coming down. You'll see that's how it happens. And when it gets low enough and it gets heavy enough, boom. Look at chapter 37, verse 11. Also, by watering, he wearieth the thick cloud. I think that's interesting. Job 26, 8. He says, he bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. All right, that was not that interesting. But he does. They did understand this. Job 38:25. This is God speaking, which is impressive if you really study what God says. 25. We're going to read through 28. Says, "Who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is?" Who would have guessed that lightning causes it to rain? But they knew that back in those days. He rains it on the wilderness where there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth. Hath the rain a father? Or who hath begotten the drops of dew? Out of whose womb came the ice? That's going too far. It says, who hath begotten the drops of dew? How does the dew form? How does the droplets form up in the air? How does that happen? Does it have a father? They're like asking this question. How does the lightning make this happen? They can see it happening, but it's like a question God is saying. Do you know how this is done? And it's truly mysterious. It's something that takes years and years of experiments to try to figure out how this happens. In fact, they're still studying it, trying to figure out what causes this cycle. You know how valuable it would be to know how to make it rain when we want it to?
They
drop some kind of a dust into the clouds to increase the water droplets that form to get the water vapor to become a cloud, to precipitate, to come out of its vapor state and become a liquid. It has to have something to attach to. It has to have what they call a cathode, or whatever they call it. It's got to have that. And so they drop the dust or something. They drop something into the cloud to cause it to coalesce, and that causes the droplets to start getting bigger. And once you have droplets, then it can, if it's enough, if the temperature's right and everything's enough, it'll start raining.
I can't make the clouds, right?
Well, yeah, you can make the clouds. Here I'm pretending to be an expert on hydrology, but if you've got the right humidity, if you've got enough humidity, and you drop at the right temperature, and you drop the dust into the clouds, it'll cause the clouds, I mean into the water vapor, it'll cause it to produce clouds, and if it does it enough and you got the right temperature, it'll cause it to rain. So you can actually cause it to rain.
I heard that's why we got our snowstorm, because they were cloud seeding in California.
Conspiracy theory. I don't know. Maybe that's it.
They mess around with stuff, and it's like when this really, really freaky stuff happens. That's not my first, but it makes me wonder, some things they shouldn't mess with. They're not going to make it better than they make it worse.
Yeah, but I would say, on the whole, the things we've messed with have really helped us. I mean, we have. Even God told us to have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the land. He told us to subjugate the earth. He told us to have dominion. So God commanded from the very beginning that we control this earth. And so I don't follow this idea that, we're messing nature up. The idea of nature, apart from humans being great, Because I know we all like to go out where there's nobody. You know, I'd like to discover a valley that, you know, no human has ever seen, which is ridiculous. But you know, go into a cave. I've explored caves. Just go into a cave. I cannot believe the danger I was in when we went and explored these caves. And we're blind inside there, you know. And how are we going to find our way out? We actually came out on the other side of the mountain. It's amazing. It was this river coming right out of the mountain. It's a huge river, the Huichihuayan River near Rio Verde in Mexico. And so you were up there, the nice swimming hole, but this river's coming right out of this grotto, right out of the mountain. So we follow it up in there, and we start climbing up in there, and it gets so dark, and we had little lights, and we're trying to shine it, and we're looking down, and there's a hole where we're walking. And we drop a rock in there, and it goes boom, 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 boom. It's like old caverns underneath us. And then one time we're walking by, and I think it was Joey, or maybe it was George Monk, because he was there with us. We had this big rock. We had this hole. Hey, wait, there's a hole right here, because we could barely see. And he had this rock. He said, okay, let's drop it. Ready? You ready? Okay, drop it. He drops this big rock, and it was a puddle of water, and it just grass just got us all wet. But we climbed through, got out on the other side. I don't know why I got off on that.
Nature.
That we're supposed to control things. We are supposed to. We're supposed to own this world. The idea of nature being the way God wanted it to be, just wild out there, just doing whatever it wants. No, that's not what God said. God planted a garden. He made a garden, and he put a man there to dress it. He wants us to have dominion over all this. So I think he wants us to learn how to make it rain. I think he wants us to learn how to make solar panels and windmills. I don't have any problem with humans trying to go to the moon and colonize it. That's what the earth is for. Nature has no value whatsoever, except to us to say it's pretty, you know. And yeah, it is pretty. And a lot of times we like to be there and have no other people around. That'd be nice. But at the same time, what God looks at is he says, I made people in my image that are going to be creators, and they're going to be doing stuff. And so I think it's a wrong thinking to think of nature as pristine and how men mess it up.
Oh, yeah, I don't
know. Yeah, it's easy to fall into that. These tree huggers.
Yes.
Tree huggers. It's easy to fall into that. I'm a little bit of a tree hugger. I don't want them cutting down any of those old growth forests anymore. I want to keep it. I want to keep them all as pristine as we can. And on, but I also think they ought to make more lakes, and they ought to, you know, make more hydroelectric plants, and they ought to. I think they ought to be doing all that stuff. Anyway, another thing, and I'm going to have to move along here. Another thing is geology. Talks about the water wearing the stones in Job. Talks about him overturning the mountains by their roots. And have you all seen that, right? You see how mountains are just turned up like this on the side. Used to be sedimentary rock, used to be flat. Now it's up here like that. God just overturns all these things. That's all mentioned. Says God does this. He cuts out the rivers in order to discover, we could read it in Job 28:9, so in order to discover precious things. And that's amazing, because that's how they populated California, because of the gold rush, because the rivers were cutting through the rock and discovering precious things. God caused this earth to be a molten thing of huge pressures underneath there, producing diamonds and gold and isolating silver and isolating lead and bubbling it up to the surface, and then having the rivers come. All of this is a tremendous design by God so that we can go around and discover this stuff. And we have. I've read books on what they call the anthropic principle, which shows how the earth is such an amazing place, because everything we need, all of the elements that are possible in nature are here on earth. You go to Mars, you're not going to find all the elements. You're not going to find all the copper and all the bauxite for aluminum. You're not going to find uranium. You're not going to find these things, but it's all here, and it's all at the surface on Earth. What's the chances of something like that? It's not normal. This is not a planet that just happens, and there's millions of them out there. The whole idea that there are millions of them out there is absurd. It is this planet is so amazing, and God made it this way so that we could discover these things, and that is brought out in the book of Job. He also mentions springs of the sea. How would the ancients know that there are springs in the sea? That there are wells, artesian wells under the ocean, just pouring out water. Well, where does the water come from? The water comes from the volcanic activity underneath. It produces water, and that turns into steam, and that turns into these springs coming out of the sea. They have these vents down in the center of the Atlantic that they're studying, and it's a tremendous thing. The water down there ought to be, you know, super cold, hyper cold, and yet it's warm because it's volcanic activity. Springs coming right out of the bottom of the ocean. This is 5 miles down, or 3 miles down, or however far down, and yet Job mentions it. Right? I mean, I should say God mentioned it in the book of Job. That's in Job 38:16. Astrophysics. Think about what it says in the book of Job, astrophysics. And remember, we're talking about probably the oldest book in existence. That there's no other book that we have that's any older than the book of Job. The only one that might be a little older is the that law code that they found over there in Samaria. It's the Sumerian law code. It's about the year 2200 BC. But that's the oldest. That's the oldest we got. We don't have records. We don't have books that are older than that. Anyway, how about Job 26:7? I think I did bring this out last week or the week before. Job 26:7. He stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Think about that. The knowledge that they had that the earth is just suspended in an empty place. We don't have much better understanding than that right now. That's what we know. It's an empty place. It's called outer space, and the earth is just suspended there, hanging on nothing. Look at that. You couldn't explain it any better than that. God mentions, look at that one, Job 38. This is God's rebuke. In Job 38, look at verse 20. Look at verse 12. Hast thou commanded the morning? This is, remember, God is rebuking Job and the rest of them. He says, hast thou commanded the morning since thy days and caused the day spring to know his place? What causes the morning to come? That it might take hold of the ends of the earth? What do you think the ends of the earth are? Henry Morris thinks he's talking about the poles, the ends of the earth, right? That the wicked might be shaken out of it. It is turned as clay to the seal. So you take a hold of the ends of the earth and then you turn it like the clay turns on the seal. And they stand as a garment. That's an interesting astrophysical reality that's brought out in the book of Job as if whoever's writing this understood it. All right, Job 11 talks about the height of heaven being infinite like God. Nobody thought, I mean, I say nobody, the ancients did, but the people lost this knowledge and they stopped realizing that heaven is infinite. Heaven is boundless. You just don't see the end of it. They all thought that the heaven was fairly near and that all those stars were up right there. But what they, in Job, it talks about them being so high like the infinity of God, like it says, that God is as high as heaven or something like that. I'm not going to go to it to read it. We got to keep moving. Several times it talks about, yeah, let's read that one. Job 22, verse 12. Receive, I pray thee, the law from his mouth and lay up his words in thine heart. That is not what I was looking for. Job, what did I say? Job 22, 12. Oh, I'm on 22. I'm in 22:22. Okay. Is not God in the height of heaven? And behold the height of the stars. How high they are. They talk about the stars being so high, that so as high as God is. And that's an interesting thought that outer space is boundless, just way out there. That's not what you find in the Greek cosmology or even in the Babylonian cosmology. This is found in the book of Job, though. Also talks about spreading out the heavens and making the constellations in Job 9. Job 38, God talks about the ordinances that he placed for heavens. I'm going to read that one. Job 38, verse 33. I love it when I read what God said, because it's like he knows something, and this clearly comes from God. Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? Can you make something like I've made, but can you do it on earth? Can you set up something on earth like I've done in heaven? God makes laws. He makes ordinances. He says, okay, I'm going to have gravity be this, and this is how it's going to work, and the distance square, you know, whatever, it's going to have attraction from the square of the distance or what have you. It's a mathematical formula, an ordinance that causes solar systems to happen. If it weren't that way, and scientists can't figure out why it has to be that exact, why it has to be that way, because, there's several enigmas about the mathematics of it. Like, magnets aren't that way. You have there's an attractive force of magnets, and it's not the square of the distance. It doesn't work. You take a magnet and roll it by another magnet, it doesn't start going in a circle. It goes wham, or it goes off. It just doesn't go in a circle. But out in outer space, you have these ordinances of heaven that cause this attractive thing called gravity, and these bodies going around it are attracted, but when they are attracted, they don't come in too close and they don't go out too far. It's a perfect balance so that it produces order. This is not accidental. This is not, and God said, God himself mentions it to Job. He says, I did this. I made ordinances for it to work. Can you do that? And we can't. We have no clue how to do that. We don't even understand gravity. I like that Job 26:13. He says he garnished the heavens. Have y'all seen the Hubble photographs? Have y'all ever gone online? Just go type in Hubble photographs and go into your Google search or your DuckDuckGo search or whatever and say, I only want to see the big pictures, the largest pictures, the wallpaper pictures, the monster ones. And then just expand them and just keep going in, because these pictures are super high resolution. So you'll get it on your camera screen there, and you'll see it. That's nice, because it's a section of the sky. And then you zoom in, and it's still very good resolution. You keep zooming in, and you just find more and more detail. These things are fantastic. Talk about garnishing the heavens. He made it gorgeous. And what they've done on those Hubble photographs is that they have expanded our visible spectrum, our visible light spectrum. What they've do, they're, the way they've got it, they've got these huge antennas out there that can catch infrared and ultraviolet light. Light that's both above and below our visible light spectrum. And what they did was they stretched out the color markings of it so that it looks like it's visible light, but it just expands the colors. And what that gives us is you actually can see all the nebula, and you can see all the different things there. We can see better than our own eyesight can see. These things are tremendous. That's just like, it'll just blow you away. And by the way, you'll never get to the end of them. They're taking these pictures every day. And you start looking, there's millions of them. They just keep coming, and every one of them is gorgeous. Every one of them is amazing. It's hard to sift through them all. All right. And finally, electromagnetism. Like, for example, Job 38:19. It's interesting how God talks about these things. 38:19 says, where is the way where light dwelleth? Who knew that light traveled? Light seemed like a energy force or whatever, but it took a while for us to realize that light has a way. Light travels. Darkness has a place. Light has a way. Darkness is stationary, and light is moving. This is not intuitive. It's not something like, I finally start realizing some things, and I start trying to figure out some things, and all of a sudden I think, oh yeah, well light travels, and darkness stays the same. But that's what it says in Job, calls it 38:19. Where did I read? Where is the way where light dwelleth, and as for the darkness, where is the place thereof? It's an interesting aspect of light and darkness that. Job 38:24 says, by what way is the light parted? Who knew you could separate light and part it? You take a prism, I don't know if you've ever seen it. Like, I wear glasses that do not have prismatic correction. I buy the cheap glasses. And so if I look off to the side, I see a yellow red ridge, and I look off the side, I see a blue ridge, you know, on the, because it's separating the light. But in a prism, your light separates, and you get to see all these different things. And the information that's in that light it's incredibly deep. The spectrum of light, that the reason why we can tell what those stars are made out of is because when light passes through a gas, certain lines are left in the spectrum. When you separate the light, you can find where those lines are, and it'll tell you what the elements are that it's passing through. So we know they're helium, we know they're hydrogen. We can tell all of this stuff by light. The information is in the light. Why in the world would that be? Why is it possible for us to know what's in the stars? Because God wanted it that way, and He put that information in the light. And He tells us you can part the light, you can separate it out, and you can find out some things. All right. Job 38:35 says, canst thou send lightnings? God says to Job, He says, well, how about you? Can you send lightnings? Just how good are you, Job? Can you send lightnings? Well, yes, we can. Did you know that it's possible to send lightnings? We can control electricity, and we basically do now. Now, not lightning. That's more electricity than all of our things together. The amount of electricity in one bolt of lightning is phenomenal. It will blow you away. It literally blow you away.
They haven't figured out how to harness that yet.
Electricity. I believe it was Benjamin Franklin had a theory about how to do it. You know, put a kite up in there and try to get this stuff in. Yeah, well, whatever. If you read about the rights of the Creator in from Job 38 all the way through Job 41, God speaking, He's saying, look, if you just read it, it's just an amazing thing. He says, where were you when I did this? Well, He talks about the verses 4 through 6, He laid the foundations of the earth. They were measured, they were precision, they were fastened. It's interesting how He talks about the foundations of the earth were measured by, it was a precise thing, they were measured, and they were fastened. God says, I did that. He put a bound on the sea. He broke up a place for it so that it would be there and not go anywhere else. And that's talking about both when He created it and after the flood. He designed the complex daily cycle, which causes the earth to turn, and it causes the polar incline so that all the earth receives light. This is an interesting thing, that the earth has an inclined pole which causes the entire earth to be usable. You know, if the pole was exactly off, then parts of the pole would never get, they would never warm up. I mean, the poles would be, we'd have ice over everything except the equator lines. Probably the Tropic of Cancer up above and the Tropic of Capricorn below would be ice forever, and they'd be unusable. It'd be like the North Pole is right now. But because it's at an incline and it's going around the sun at that inclination, it gets hot and cold all through the year, and it causes almost the entire earth to be habitable. Very, very, fortuitous, but also a genius. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of that. You know, if I had thought of any of that, anything like that, I wouldn't have come up with that kind of sophistication. How about, he talks about the size of the earth. See, 38:18. Hast thou perceived the breadth of the earth? The size of the earth is extremely important. If it's a little bit bigger, we don't work. And if it's a little bit smaller, we don't work. It doesn't happen. None of this that we have would be possible. We wouldn't be able to keep the water. The water would not be able to evaporate. the Earth wouldn't keep its atmosphere, or the Earth would gather heavier gases like methane, like Jupiter or whatever, and life would not be possible. The Earth is the exact right size. Talks about the enigma of light, the bound of light, the house of light, the parting of light. Job 38 talks about the treasures of the snow and the hail, peculiar properties of ice. Have you considered the very peculiar property of ice? How ice, when it freezes, expands, which causes it to float, which is different than all other liquids. Any other liquid, when it turns into an ice, it contracts more. Like, take aluminum. Aluminum, from the point of liquid to solid, from liquid to solid, loses 6% of its volume. I know that because I pour aluminum into these little clay things, whatever, and you have to calculate that, because if you want it a certain size, you got to make it 6% bigger. So you just calculate that up, then you pour it in there, and it'll shrink down 6% of its volume. But not ice. Ice gets bigger. And that's absolutely critical for life to exist. Ice has to get bigger. And that's part of the actual molecular structure of it. That's in the design of it from the very beginning. And it's mentioned, peculiar properties of ice. That's in verse 30. The waters are hid as with a stone, the face of the deep is frozen. Who hath gendered the hoary frost? Out of whose womb came the ice? All right, the complex process of rain. We've already talked about that. The ordinances of heaven. Oh, 38, 36 says, who hath put wisdom in the inward parts? Who hath given understanding to the heart? This is one of the most enigmatic mysteries. They are still trying to figure it out. Have you ever studied the science of artificial intelligence? I mean, I don't mean study it like in college. Go to Wikipedia and just try to read what they talk about artificial intelligence. Folks, they're not even close. There's no such thing as artificial intelligence. The stuff that they advertise, say, artificial intelligence is doing this and whatever, it's in our cars and all that. No, that's just complex programs. It's not intelligence. The intelligence is the person that looks at it and says, this is dumb, you know, like a stupid smart light that stops the entire lane of traffic of 150 cars so one car can go beep, 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 beep and come out. Those are stupid smart lights. That's our artificial intelligence. That's sophisticated programs that causes your freezer to beep if you leave the door open. That's all it's talking about. Intelligence is not understood. They try to think of it as now it's a computer. They thought because we've discovered computers, good old Babbitt discovered the computer, and since then we've you know, become sophisticated. All these computers are amazing, and they really are, but they're just number crunchers. And our brains do not work like computers. We do not remember, our brains do not have storage places, and it does not do these computing things. Our brain works completely different. It's a big mistake to think of the brain as a supercomputer. And it's a huge mistake to think if we get enough computers stuck together, a mind will emerge. That's the stupidest thought they've ever had. Minds do not emerge from computers. This, you know, the Matrix, where the computers are running everything, you know, or things like, stupid. It's just stupid because computers aren't smart. They don't have any intelligence. How did it come? How does our mind, how does a little baby's brain turn into a brilliant thing? God says, can you figure that out? I put the wisdom in there. God is the Father of spirits. That's our God. And then he starts talking about lions, ravens, goats, hinds, wild asses, unicorns, which is either the rhinoceros or some kind of an extinct ox. Peacocks, ostriches, horses, grasshoppers, hawks, eagles. God starts talking about all these things like he's proud of them. Says, look what I did. Yeah? Look what I did. Look there. How about the ostrich? I deprived her of wisdom. She lays her eggs and forgets where she put them. Then she steps on them. That's God talking. It's interesting. Then he talks about Behemoth. This is a huge creature that has a tail like a cedar. It's called the chief of the ways of God. He's obviously symbolically talking about the devil. And Leviathan, which is also called the devil, in, I believe it's in Revelation, also called a dragon in Isaiah 27:1. This thing is a sea-dwelling reptilian, has teeth, has scales, breathes fire, swims in the sea. Then he says he was made without fear, and he's king over the children of pride, also symbolizing Satan. Has it dawned upon you that the book of Job winds everything up at the end with God talking about why he deals with Satan? Because that's how it starts at the beginning. God is dealing with Satan and actually puts Job through a tremendous amount of heartache in order for God to make a point to Satan. And God's saying, I have that right. I'm making my points. Who are you to object? All right. That's all I got. Oh, I'll give you one more thing. Resurrection of the body found in Job 5 times. It says, though he trust me, though he slay me, yet will I trust him, he shall be my salvation. Though he slay me, he shall be my salvation. Job 14, he lieth down, the dead lieth down, riseth not till the heavens be no more. After the heavens end is a resurrection. Job 14, he's going to appoint me a time, I will wait until my change come. That's what he says there. In Job 19, in my flesh I shall see God. Job 33:28, he'll bring back his soul from the pit and he'll walk in the light of the living. That's what I got about Job. What'd you say? You have a question?
Oh, no. The man that was born blind, there was a reason for that. Can you explain?
Yeah, for the glory of God, for that one point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the reason was his glory.
Yeah.
He wanted to be glorified in him, so he made him blind for however many years.
Born
blind. And it was also that God could have one moment of glory. If there's one point to Job, the book of Job, it's that God has the right to do whatever he wants to us and that we ought to truly worship him over that. For his pleasure. All things were made for his pleasure. You know, and that's throughout the Bible, you'd think we'd be more cognizant of it, just a little more aware of how big God is and how much right he has to us. We should defer to him a little more. It's like when he says, why would you be covetous if I've told you I'll never leave you nor forsake you? Why in the world would you get greedy? I just, love of money is the root of all evil and we all suffer with it, but why? If God is so big and God has given us so much. And all right, well, let's pray and dismiss us. Thank you, Lord, for your book. Thank you for your gifts. Thank you for your wonderful knowledge. Thank you for giving us understanding, Lord, that we know you as our God. Bless us in our plans, Lord, our ways home, and bless our meetings on Sunday. I ask in Jesus' name. Amen.